Author and journalist Jeff Gwynn's new book, The Road to Jonestown, Jim Jones and People's Temple, sheds new light on a subject we thought we knew. Jim Jones, the man responsible for the deaths of more than 900 people at Jonestown in Guyana. Drawing on a host of new interviews and sources, Gwynn delivers an authoritative account of one of the most notorious figures in American history and looks to answer the question, how could this tragedy have happened? Again, the name of the book is The Road to Jonestown, Jim Jones and People's Temple, and we welcome Jeff Gwynn to the roundtable this morning. Jeff, thank you very much for being with us.
It's always good to be back. Thanks for inviting me again.
Thank you very much. Given that you have written about everybody from Manson to Santa Claus, what brought you to Jim Jones?
Well, I try to write about different eras in American history, and since my last book was about Charles Manson in the 1960s, I wanted to kind of segue into the 1970s and follow what happened next. I thought my two choices for the most iconic memories of the 1970s were either Watergate, and there sure didn't seem to be much need for another book on that, or the phrase, "Don't drink the Kool-Aid," which, as you know, of course, is related to Jonestown and what happened there in 1978. And it wasn't Kool-Aid, and the things we think happened there didn't really happen that way, so I felt there was a need for a book.
So when you look at a starting place in this, for you, where did you want to begin in looking at Jim Jones?
Well, I think for anyone who has such a profound impact on our history, and one of the things we need to accept is Jim Jones did. We're still talking about him 39 years after his death, and we've got that catchphrase that's become part of our lexicon. I always think we need to go back with everyone to childhood and even their parents and sometimes their grandparents. Nothing happens in a vacuum. Everything people do is connected to something else, usually in their past. So I started out by spending an awful lot of time in rural Indiana, and of course I ended up deep in the Guyanese jungle, which is one of the densest and most venomous reptile infested in the world.
So let us talk a little bit about that time in Indiana. He was a real human rights, civil rights leader in Indiana, looking to integrate Indianapolis. Give us a sense of where that passion for civil rights came from and ultimately what he was able to accomplish.
I think most of us like to see our villains as 100% evil, and of course, very few people are that. That includes Jim Jones. As a child, he was raised in one of the few rural communities in Indiana where there were black enclaves nearby. So he was one of the few white kids growing up in that state during the 1930s and 40s who had black people that he would encounter just about every day. Even in his childhood, he was fiercely committed to racial equality, and as a teenager would get on the bus and go to the nearest big town, which was Richmond, and he would preach on Saturdays on street corners that everybody's created equal. When he started his first early ministry in Indianapolis, he set out to integrate one of the most segregated cities in America, and gradually, bit by bit, he really succeeded. Everything from housing to open shopping. And remember, he's doing these things as head of the City Human Relations Commission 15 years or more before the civil rights legislation makes it mandatory. He was a great leader in the early civil rights movement. That doesn't in any way negate the terrible things he did later in life, but he started his career with genuine accomplishments.
You write about this in the book, and it is fascinating, and it looks to a cult of personality in some ways, I guess, but how he was able to amass so many followers to the church, what he was able to do to draw so many people in.
Jones was capable of appealing to any number of types of individual, and that's something that only the most successful demagogues can do. People's Temple was a mixed-race church. many of the people of color came from the lower income bracket, but Jones also attracted a lot of white professionals, particularly young white professionals in the 1960s who wanted to get involved in the push for equal rights, not just for people of color, but for every gender, every religion, every background. So what he would do in any one sermon, and they're fascinating to listen to. The tapes are available online. You can listen to anything, really, about Jim Jones there. Is in the process of any sermon, he would say something that would directly appeal to everyone in that room, even though so many of them came to him for different reasons. And they all had this one thing in common, that they believed their church could set what they called a socialist example, everyone treated with equal respect and dignity, no matter what their color, what their gender, what they owned or didn't own. They felt if they did this and did it efficiently enough, the rest of the world would follow along. Jim Jones preyed on that. Certainly the church accomplished some fine things, but as Jones got stranger and more paranoid and more of a megalomaniac as the years went by, he twisted those great intentions.
Do you think, and I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but do you think there was ever, this was part of a master plan, or was this the degradation of a human mind that allowed him to become such an evil figure?
I don't think Jim Jones planned ahead that much. I do believe that, again, like all demagogues, he came to believe that anything he wanted or said had to be the right thing. He certainly became less concerned with helping others, more concerned with increasing his own power. He was always about power and control. So, sadly, I think what we've got is not someone who's mentally ill. He never was that. But he's a great example of what happens when we allow someone to raise themselves to such a pinnacle of power that they don't allow criticisms, that no one questions their judgment, that essentially they tell followers, you must believe in me because everyone else out there is the enemy.
You do write in the book that rampant drug use certainly played a role in the change in personality and the change in who he became.
Jones was a heavy drug abuser, probably starting in the 1960s, early 1960s in California. He particularly abused amphetamines, and of course, that kind of thing will, if you're already paranoid, increase the paranoia considerably. One of the things we remember most about Jim Jones is the dark glasses that he would wear in public almost constantly. He told his followers that's because he had so much power that if they looked directly into his eyes, they might burn up. The reality of it was he had to wear the dark glasses to hide his eyes because the whites of those eyes were bright red from drug abuse.
One of the things that surprised me in the book is that he was very successful in Indiana, very successful then in California. And people like the governor of California then and the governor now of California, Jerry Brown, had many good things to say about the church and its efforts and its accomplishments, including, and so did the vice president, Walter Mondale, and even the first lady, Rosalynn Carter, for the types of social services that the People's Temple provided.
People's Temple, under the leadership of Jim Jones, continued creating great positive programs almost towards the end. It's simply that the bad things began to outweigh the good. In terms of politicians wanting to be close to Jones, wanting his support, he was very clever at putting together sort of a large voting entity. Members of People's Temple were, of course, urged to register to vote, and Jones was very careful to make sure they voted for who he wanted them to vote for. And when you're talking a church of 5,000 people with hundreds of thousands of followers and contributors around the country, that's quite a block. Jones knew how to use that political power. And one of the things that scared the heck out of me, before in the mid-1970s, the first investigative stories in newspapers began driving him away from America and into Guyana. He was thinking about running for office himself, and he was brilliant at manipulating public perceptions, and of course, as we've proven lately, unlikely folks can be elected president of the United States, and Jones might have gone for that.
Jeff Gwynn is our guest. The name of the new book is The Road to Jonestown, Jim Jones and People's Temple. In reading the book, I got the impression, and I think that this is if I read correctly and if I understand this correctly, that Jonestown and moving to Guyana was always part of a plan, or as you say, he didn't work too far ahead, but this was part of a plan to have a satellite program outside of the United States. There would be a farm, they would grow produce that could be distributed to the needy along the coast of South America. At what point did it then become the refuge and the place that he would escape to?
Originally, the plan for Jonestown was that it would support maybe 500 people, that they would carve a working farm out of this almost impossible jungle. And it was in process of being developed when stories in the media in California pointing out many of the problems with People's Temple, mostly through Jones's abuse, cost Jones a lot of his political support in America, and he had to run. He thought he had to, not only to maintain some control of his people, but because there were lawsuits and even some custody battles coming up in U.S. courts. So when he fled in the mid-1970s to Jonestown in the jungle, taking with him almost 1,000 of his followers, that did a couple things. First of all, there were terribly overcrowded conditions there. 14 people were crammed in cottages built for five. There was hardly enough food to go around. But most of all, you've got these people now, Jones's core followers, isolated from the rest of the world. There's 150 miles of dense jungle between them and the nearest major city. It's hard to get in. It's impossible to get out. And there you have Jim Jones growing more paranoid by the day, gradually convincing his followers that at any moment the U.S. military, the FBI, the CIA, trained mercenaries might come storming in to attack them. So he builds up their fear of what the outside world may be intending for them. And at the same time, you know, he doesn't give up on the drugs. He has a ready supply even in the jungle, and he grows more and more paranoid.
When you look at the timeline from going to Guyana to the horrendous events of November 11, 1978, it's a rather short span of time, isn't it?
Well, things speeded up a lot. Jones was becoming more and more paranoid. There were certainly legal pressures back in the States, and he was feeling that. Ultimately, what Jones wanted was, if not in a terrifically long life for himself, then at least some conclusion to it that would be so memorable his name would resonate ever afterwards, and sadly it looks like he accomplished that part. But what it doesn't take into account is that the people in Jonestown, most of them suffering greatly, though some of them like the primitive life, at this point, many are less dedicated to Jim Jones himself. They've seen enough of his strange behavior. Then they're still dedicated to the original purpose of People's Temple. They want to set this example that treating everyone equally, having no boundaries of race or gender or economics, would really be the best way for the rest of the world to operate. So it's a tense situation. It's getting tenser. And then finally, in 1978, a Bay Area congressman responds to complaints from constituents who say they think they have relatives being held in Jonestown against their will. And in November 1978, Leo Ryan, some press, and some of the relatives go to Guyana to confront Jim Jones and enter Jonestown. And, of course, that precipitated the end.
When you consider the behavior that became increasingly erratic, And yet he was still able to hold on to those people and to those followers to the point where 900 plus people followed his orders at the end. What does that say about what he was able to do and what those people were looking for in him?
What we're seeing, I think, and the reason that it's still important to try to understand what happened that day, is that demagogues like Jones increase their power and their control over people incrementally. This didn't happen overnight. It happens over a period of decades where people not only swear their allegiance to them, but they give up everything to follow him. To be a member of People's Temple, you had to pretty much give up your house, your car, any jewelry, antiques are sold at People's Temple secondhand shops. When they were in Jonestown, in Guyana with Jones, he'd taken their passports. They had no money. If you want to leave Jonestown, basically you're going to have to go through 150 miles of jungle, and if you survive that, how do you pay to get home if you don't have money, and how can you leave and enter the U.S. if you don't have your passport? So he's essentially robbing them of their exit and at the same time browbeating them and convincing most of them that they are in mortal danger from enemies, specifically the U.S. government. When Leo Ryan arrives, he enters Jonestown and only finds 15 of the settlers who say, yes, I want to leave. Now think, that leaves over 900. Ryan believes that Jones has made his point, that nobody's being held against their will. If these people said they wanted to go, Jones is saying, fine, here's the passports and money. But to Jim Jones, it was only the beginning of the end so far as he was concerned. If you let one congressman who takes out 15 of your people, somebody else is going to come soon. And meanwhile, those living in Jonestown are going to realize we really can get out. They're less likely to stay. He orders Ryan murdered at an airstrip 6 miles away as he's leaving. Four other people die. There are some terribly wounded back in Jonestown. Jones calls everybody together, says something's happened to the congressman. I didn't do it, which is one of his lies. But then tells them that this is it. At any moment now, they're going to come for us. They're going to take the children and do terrible things to them. They're going to take our old people. We need to create a revolutionary act that isn't suicide. Show our disdain, cross to the other side. That's when he brings out the vat of Flavor-Aid drink mix, and that's mixed around with cyanide and tranquilizers, and he tells everyone this is that moment.
You have talked about this a couple of times in our discussion of being synonymous with the expression, don't drink the Kool-Aid. Talk a little bit about, while it is understandable how we got that impression, it is a deeply flawed and incorrect impression.
Well, don't drink the Kool-Aid is a phrase that's come to mean don't be an idiot. Don't blindly follow a leader who clearly is making no sense. That doesn't take into account, first of all, the paranoia and the brainwashing that's been going on in Jonestown, where these folks haven't had a chance to hear anything from the outside world. And the second thing is, it wasn't a voluntary act on the part of many, probably most of the people who died that day. Jones had a tape recorder running, and if you go on the internet again, you can listen to this. He has some followers, maybe 100, who believe in him so much that if he says take poison and die, they'll do it. But then there's everyone else. We're talking about almost 300 children, including infants, who have no say in it whatsoever. I mean, they're pretty much force-fed the poison and they die. Maybe 200 old people, pretty decrepit. They're only in Jonestown because their Social Security checks were needed, but if they're left there on their own in this jungle, they're going to die anyway. There are some people who clearly are just so exhausted, so fed up. I don't believe you, but I've had enough of this. That we have nowhere to go. Fine, give me the damn poison, I'll take it. And then, and this is confirmed through autopsies, at least 4 dozen people, maybe as many as 100 or more, fight. They don't want to do this, but there are armed guards. Those who don't want the poison are held down and forcibly injected. We know this from the abscesses found on their bodies. So ultimately, over 900 people die in a horrible way in that horrible place. And yet very few willingly, and none of them in the full knowledge that they didn't have to do this. So it was never mass suicide. It was mass murder.
How did Jim Jones himself and his wife die?
Marceline Jones died from the poison. She didn't go willingly. The couple people who escaped that day remember her screaming, "You can't do this, you can't do this," but it was out of control. Jim Jones was one of only two people that day who didn't die from cyanide poisoning. He died from a gunshot wound to the head, as did his personal nurse, Annie Moore. There's no way of being sure. The tape ran out before this moment. But I suspect strongly, after studying Jim Jones for years, that the suffering of those who were dying from the poison, cyanide poisoning, is one of the most painful ways to die. You suffocate slowly. At the last minute, he preferred something quick, and Annie Moore was given the honor of dispatching him and then being allowed to die in the same way.
You're hesitant. You do not use the word cult.
We think of cults as religious groups who rely on some biblical prophecy and a certain fundamentalist mania to believe that they are the only ones living in the proper way, the end is coming, everyone else is going to hell or dying terribly. People's Temple never was organized or joined with the idea that anyone would be forced to live the way that People's Temple wanted, that there would be any violent overthrow of anything. Certainly wasn't based on biblical prophecy saying, okay, in Revelation it says we're coming to the end of days. It was always an effort by people who deeply wanted a fairer, more equitable world to bring it about not just by talking, but by living as an example. The people who died that day in Guyana, excepting Jim Jones, were some of the finest, most socially conscious people that anyone could ever want to meet. The survivors that I've talked to, that I've met, are wonderful men and women, and I'm proud now to call some of them my lifelong friends. So cult has so many negative implications. If we're going to think of it in that very traditional way, then no, it doesn't apply to People's Temple.
The name of the book is The Road to Jonestown, Jim Jones and People's Temple. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Jeff Gwynn, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
Thank you, Joe, and I appreciate the chance to come back and talk to your listeners.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of Jeff Gwynn's new book is The Road to Jonestown, Jim Jones and People's Temple, published by Simon & Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.